This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Ryan Smiley. He's the CEO of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Northwest Indiana, talking about the work that is to begin later in the year to the Catherine House in the Harbor neighborhood in East Chicago. It's a major capital enhancement and renovation project, and it comes at a good time for the historic building, and there's been a lot of already dedicated support for the work to be done. We have also for you another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University today, and also a conversation with Brad Miller. He's the Northwest Indiana Regional Director of Indiana Landmarks. This year's Century of Progress Homes Talk and Tour to be held in Beverly Shores is sold out, and it was just a matter of minutes after the tickets went for sale. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
2019 is a very important year for the Catherine House, which is based over in East Chicago. It's going to be the 100-year celebration of the Catherine House and the partnership that put together the East Chicago Catherine House Boys and Girls Club. And we now know that there's been some interesting work that's planned for not only the historic building itself, but also all of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Northwest Indiana celebrating the 100-year celebration with a big project. And for all of this, we're going to turn to the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Northwest Indiana CEO, Ryan Smiley. Ryan, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate all of the support you guys show and provide, not only to the Boys and Girls Clubs, but our community at large. So appreciate the opportunity to share with the public just a few quick updates and some exciting things happening with the Boys and Girls Clubs in Greater Northwest Indiana.
First, we should explain to our listeners who may or may not be familiar how the East Chicago Boys and Girls Club got involved with the Catherine House. Tell us about the Catherine House. Sure. Catherine House itself is very, very, very interesting history in its own right.
Absolutely. You know, the Catherine House was founded by the local faith-based community in the Harbor area of East Chicago, and the building actually was constructed in 1919, and the purpose of the facility, the original Catherine House, was to give young kids a place to go. At that time, in that era, in that community, actually juvenile delinquency was a problem recognized by the faith-based community, and so they constructed this facility that was for youth and youth only in the after-school, out-of-school time setting. Fast forward to the early 70s, and at the time, the East Chicago Boys Club was added to the organization as the third Boys and Girls Club in Lake County at the time. That time period, our community leaders recognized that they were duplicating services to some extent with the Catherine House and the Boys and Girls Club, and the organizations voted to merge the Catherine House and the Boys Club to the East Chicago Catherine House Boys and Girls Club. And as a condition of that merger, which took place in the late 70s, girls were admitted for the first time in the Boys Club as a result of the Catherine House merging with the Boys and Girls Club at the time.
Now, I understand that not only with the historic building in its own right, that it started out as a youth center set up by a church, it's gotten turned into a Boys and Girls Club center itself, but the building itself is needs to have some work done. Obviously, with a building that old, it doesn't stand by itself for long.
Yeah, that is correct. You know, in the late 80s, the organization built a facility right across the street from the original Catherine House. The original Catherine House is still standing. However, a facility was built and opened in 1991. The Boys and Girls Club conducted a capital campaign and built that building, which really hasn't had any improvements to it since it opened in 1991. And so that is the actual structure that we will be completely renovating here in the near future.
Now, based on the research that you all did and the consultants and all that you had look into this more deeply with the engineers and those people that know best how these things should be done, what have they said needs to be done for the old Catherine House to bring it back up to snuff, so to speak?
You know, we're looking at a complete facility renovation, interior, exterior, HVAC, the entire infrastructure. The bones are good. The bones on the building are good.
That's good.
But we need to ensure its relevancy and sustainability for another 100 years. And so we're going to not only renovate the building, but we're going to infuse it with state-of-the-art equipment and programming that's relevant with kids today.
Don't you think that's probably a testament to the folks that built the building originally in a neighborhood that was fringed by industry, with the steel mills not all that far away and a lot of their other industry around? They probably want to be sure they built that building right the first time.
You're absolutely right. You know, it's amazing the architectural and facility structures that were built in those days. You know, are very, very solid and still standing.
Now we've gotten to the point. Now we have the recognition of the capital enhancement and renovation project for the Catherine House. Tell us how the progress is going to be handled, who's going to be in charge of it, and all the partners that are working with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Northwest Indiana to make sure this project gets done right.
Yeah, thanks for that. You know, I'll give you a little back history on how this came about, because it's very non-traditional in starting a capital campaign. About 18 months ago, had an anonymous donor contact me that was from the area, grew up and attended the Catherine House as a youth. And so I met this individual out and gave them a tour of the facility, and then took them to our newest facility in Chesterton, our Dunlin Boys and Girls Club, which is a $5 million renovation expansion that opened in 2017, and showed this individual what the vision for the future of our clubs for our kids in this area will look like. And that was all it took. This individual bought into that vision and wanted to make sure that the kids in East Chicago had the same opportunities and experiences that kids elsewhere throughout Northwest Indiana had. And so we spent a lot of time talking about what this will look like, and we received an initial $250,000 gift from this particular anonymous donor. Mm-hmm. That's out of state, and with that came a challenge match. So there was another $250,000 on the table if we could raise $125,000. So it was a 2-for-1 match, which would have been a $625,000 campaign. But what we quickly realized while we engaged local contractors and architects, that it was going to take more than that. And so we went back to the table and we decided that we need to raise $1.25 million to do this right. Yep. And so with that, we approached the Foundations of East Chicago, which receives their funding from the local gaming revenues from Ameristar Casino, and they have a very big philanthropic mission and vision to support that local community and have assets to do so. And they bought into our plans. And with that, came to the table with a $500,000 gift over 5 years to match the initial $500,000 that was on the table. And so with just two foundations, one anonymous and one local in East Chicago, we've already raised $1 million towards our $1.25 million goal.
That's the way that you get started. I suppose you can actually get some things done. Well, how's the project coming along as far as timetable is concerned? You have the kickoff recently here about the capital enhancement and renovation project. Where are things going to go from here? How soon are actually people going to start working in the facility?
Yeah, so we hope by the end of this year that we will actually begin the interior renovations during the winter time. Most of that indoor work can be completed, and then sometime early to mid spring in 2019, we hope to be absolutely completed with all of the interior renovations and start on the exterior. Mm-hmm. It's ironic that, you know, after we announced this, we've had some more individuals and organizations and municipalities support us and talk about even greater plans than we already have. And so it's really kind of building some momentum. The facility plans are in place, but we have an opportunity to possibly do some greater exterior expansions right around the club there. So We will continue to maintain operations and have a place for kids to go throughout the renovation and construction process, but our clubs don't open until after school, so during the day, those contractors will be able to get in there and get some work completed while maintaining a safe environment for the kids in the afternoon.
Now, since this whole project starts out with a building that was built back in the early 20th century in the Harbor neighborhood, do you think that this is just going to help build on this project in particular, going to help build on the improvements and making the entire neighborhood a much, much nicer place to live?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the intention here. Working closely with the City of East Chicago, Mayor Copeland has been a great supporter of this project, and that community is being revitalized, and we think that this project will certainly further enable the opportunities for kids and families in the particular Harbor area, but also all of East Chicago. We've got a wonderful relationship with the schools, City of East Chicago Superintendent Paige McNulty and her entire staff, and so we think we're going to attract many, many more kids. We're anticipating a 50% growth in attendance as a result of the renovations of this project.
Wow.
So we anticipate probably in the neighborhood of 250, 275 kids a day will be served come this time next year.
Well, that's great to hear. And we certainly appreciate you filling us in on the latest on the particulars about the capital enhancement and renovation project. And glad to hear that it's going to get started here during the winter months, and people will see some work done inside the Catherine House and find more young people coming into Northwest Indiana in the region over time. And this will mean in East Chicago in particular greater opportunities for recreation and some place for young people to go after school in East Chicago. And we appreciate you taking time to explain things to us today, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, and everyone at Lakeshore Media. We appreciate your support.
Glad to help. Ryan Smiley is the CEO of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Northwest Indiana, and the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Northwest Indiana are celebrating 100 years of the Catherine House in East Chicago. Actually, it'll be next year, we should say. 2019 is when the actual centennial happens, but they're doing some great work inside the building to make it strong for the next century to come after that. Hundreds of teachers are running for office across the country. Their campaigns are focusing primarily on school funding and teacher pay, the same issues that led teachers in Arizona, Kentucky, and Oklahoma to walk out in protest earlier this year. In Indiana, the pool of teacher candidates is smaller, but as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us, they echo similar frustrations in public education.
John Hurley's classroom looks more like a workshop than anything. Old industrial machines sit quiet, waiting, while other parts of the room come alive as students begin working on different projects. As students cut metal or assemble small engine parts, Hurley checks on each of them.
That animal's going to be noisy. If you want the earmuffs, we can get those again. No big deal. I'll have you on your engines and you guys continuing on. All right. Let's get to work, please.
Hurley's taught career and technical education here in Spencer County for nearly a decade. He loves his job, but he says lately new policies from lawmakers have taken power away from people in schools, the ones directly affected by the changes.
Most of that control has gone essentially to Indianapolis.
Hurley wants to give public schools and educators more say in important decisions. So this year, he's running for a seat in Indiana's General Assembly.
I wouldn't be doing this, one, if I didn't think it needed to be done. And I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think it was possible to win the position.
He's not the only educator with eyes on the State House. A handful of others in Indiana are running, with many more in other states. School funding is a big motivator, nationwide and for Hoosiers. A report earlier this year shows Indiana's public education funding never returned to pre-recession levels after adjusting for inflation. Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith says the political surge of educators is part of a national public education movement called Red for Ed.
I think the wave that you've seen across the country is just beginning to bubble up here.
Seemingly constant shifts in policy have educators on edge, too. Meredith says not every lawmaker needs to be an expert in education, but they have a responsibility to talk to people who are.
And by experts, I'm not talking about, you know, university leaders out on the East Coast or the West Coast. I'm talking about people right here in Indiana right now who are on the ground doing this work every single day.
State Representative Tony Cook has seen both sides. His teaching and school administration experience spans 40 years. He's retired now and serves as the vice chair on the House Education Committee. He says the reality of lawmaking means even the best bills hardly ever leave the State House the way they started.
You don't walk in here and just change everything yourself. You can't do it. You've got to build coalitions. You've got to find the people that believe the way you do. And then you work in compromising situations.
A law Cook authored earlier this year changed how schools can manage their funds. He says he hears teachers' frustrations and agrees they should earn more money, but they aren't the only ones asking.
Teachers need to understand that okay, you got everybody else waiting in line. You got all these other people coming at you, firemen, police, and that never stops.
Lawmakers reconvene in January. The next session includes crafting the state budget, meaning teacher pay and education funding will certainly take the stage. Educators and their unions will be watching closely as the next session plays out, and whether teacher candidate Hurley is doing that from his classroom or from a seat in the State House, he says his campaign and those of other teachers have already sent a message.
It shows that we will step up. And we will, again, advocate for our students, for the schools, and for the communities around this state.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I got to experience homelessness. I got to experience living on others. I got to experience all that. So it gave me more respect for people who are out there homeless, that they're not invisible. But I used to be that kind of person. I would judge people. I wasn't letting things stop me, and I was doing it. What's wrong with them? And then I became that person. And it wasn't until then I understood not to judge, not to assume they don't want anything out of life. My husband was 19, I was 16, and so we went to his sister's, and that's where we lived until I had our child, and then once I had the baby, we had our own apartment. I decided to move from Indiana and to try to better myself so I could be better for my kids. I went to school at Ivy Tech, and that's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I went as for a medical assistant, and I did graduate and began working. That was the beginning of, you know, me paying my own way. It felt so good. It was so nice to see your name on a paycheck and know that you created this and that you can choose how to spend it. In the process of that, I did remarry to a great guy. He had some of the same goals that I did, being family oriented. He helped raise my kids. Gosh, he was just so great, you know. But he passed away 2 years after his death, which was in 2007. I became disabled. My diagnosis was post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression. And those were very dark times for me. I didn't feel I deserved to be happy because he wasn't there with me to share the happiness that we shared together. And so everything we worked for, I gave all away. I find myself in a circle that it's like a fishbowl. I want to venture out because that's the drive I have inside. But that person, I'm like, where are you? Push through. A lot of people don't come back, and I was one of them that I just didn't have my drive anymore. Within the last couple of months, my family called and talked about mom and dad, how they're declining. That's what brought me back here to Indiana. I may not be able to have gainful employment, but all my skills that I have learned in the medical field and everything that I picked up, I feel so good that I could say I'm using them to help my parents. Being a couch surfer may not be bad for a lot of people, but I've always had the drive to not depend on others. So for me to couch surf back and forth, it was still like a disappointment to myself, because every parent always wanna keep a roof over their head where their child could come. You may not be able to put the spread out like you used to, but you just wanna know you always got a place where your kids can come and have coffee with you and talk about what's going on in their life.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Two companies planning to build wind farms in central Indiana are facing opposition because of health concerns. It's not uncommon for wind farm projects to be contested. There are at least seven groups in the state that either oppose wind turbines in their counties or they want stricter ordinances. But there's not a lot of research that definitively links turbines to negative health outcomes. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports on what scientists have to say.
Mariah Mershon's 7-year-old son, Jameson, has Dravet syndrome, a rare form of epilepsy. A lot of things can trigger a seizure for him. Overstimulation, extreme temperatures, sounds, flashing lights. Mershon says they've done a lot of work to make their home a safe space for him.
We had some trees in the front yard. Well, when the sun would set in the evening, it would shine through into this room. And when the wind would blow, the branches would move, and that was enough to set him off into a seizure. So my husband had to cut the trees down.
But two wind farm companies are planning projects where they live in Montgomery County. And Mershon worries shadow flicker, a kind of strobe effect from wind turbine shadows, could be another trigger.
I mean, it may come to the point where we have to say, we have to move.
Other residents are worried about less severe symptoms, like sleeplessness, headaches, ears ringing, dizziness, and nausea, something often called wind turbine syndrome. Though few reputable reports show any link between wind turbines and health, there are some areas that could use more long-term study. Let's start with shadow flicker. According to the Epilepsy Society, there's a possibility wind turbines could trigger a seizure for 3% of epileptics. Professor Arnold Wilkins researches photosensitive epilepsy at the University of Essex in the UK. We reached him through Skype.
One of the worst contexts is where the turbine blade shadow covers a window, cuts across a window, because then the illumination of a room, regardless of where you are in that room, is fluctuating. And that can be very disturbing, not only for people with epilepsy, but everybody else.
Whether or not someone with photosensitive epilepsy has a seizure from shadow flicker depends on a host of factors. Location, weather, time of year, time of day, how fast the turbine is turning, and where the person is standing. In general, Wilkins says said person would have to stand fairly close to the turbine and look at it during sunrise or sunset hours. Still, he says, for a highly sensitive person like Jameson Mershon, it's likely he would be affected by a nearby turbine. Another main concern people have about wind farms is infrasound, the low-frequency sound that a turbine gives off as it turns. A lot of things in our world make infrasound, from household appliances and cars to ocean waves and even our own heartbeat. Amir Farboud co-authored one of the first peer-reviewed articles on infrasound and wind turbines. Speaking via Skype, he says it's clear wind turbines produce infrasound, and that exposure to infrasound could affect how the inner ear works.
But what you cannot do is put two and two together and make five. You cannot say infrasound from wind turbines causes wind turbine syndrome, because there isn't the clinical evidence out there to make that conclusion.
But some researchers say just the act of worrying about wind farms can cause health problems. Simon Chapman is a professor emeritus at the Sydney School of Public Health in Australia and co-authored a book on wind turbine syndrome.
we have an expression, someone's worried sick about something, and that's what can happen. If you're experiencing anxiety, you can manifest that anxiety in physically measurable symptoms.
Via Skype, Chapman says it can affect things like your heart rate, blood pressure, and how you sleep. Aaron Baker is a senior development manager with Apex Clean Energy, one of the wind companies hoping to build a wind farm in Montgomery County. She's set up at an office in Crawfordsville, where Baker says she makes herself available to hear resident concerns.
We do take all their concerns, no matter who they are, very seriously. And so I think transparency and communication is the biggest thing that we've been trying to do.
Both wind companies say they're still leasing land from interested parties and haven't decided where the turbines will go yet. But Apex's Aaron Baker says, at the end of the day, any kind of business is bound to have some sort of impact on residents nearby. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Well, about this time of year, we have a chance to check in to find out if the Indiana Landmarks annual Century of Progress talks and tours are going to go off. Well, as it turns out, the event coming up in Beverly Shores, where you get a chance to tour the 1933 Century of Progress homes, as well as learn more about the event itself, is coming up. In fact, Friday, September 28th is when the annual Century of Progress talks and tours are going to happen in Beverly Shores. And the sellout is just an amazing one. This year, it sold out within a matter of minutes, it seemed, once the Indiana Landmarks put it up on the website available. We have with us to talk about it here our Northwest Indiana Regional Director, Brad Miller. Of course, his office is based in Miller, but he and his colleagues will make the trek out to Beverly Shores for the big event on September 28th. And Brad, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking to talk about the sellout and about the event itself for everybody who won't be able to make it out there this year.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Chris. And we're excited to see everyone come out and take a look at the house.
Now, I understand that if you told me that the sellout happened within 30 minutes after it was put up online, is this a record of some kind that you know of?
I'd have to say this is probably the fastest we've ever sold out compared to previous years. And I can also report that, unfortunately, the traffic volume was so high on our website that it actually crashed the page for a moment. So it really shows how popular the tour is, and we typically don't get too many repeat offenders. So fresh faces and fresh minds take a look at these spectacular houses.
Now, we know September 28th is the date that's set aside for the annual visit. Sometime between 7 p.m. and 9 p.m., I guess, is when the tour is going, or the talk is going to happen. Tell us about the talk and how it's related to the actual tour itself coming up for the Century of Progress houses.
Well, yeah, we like to give a talk the night before, and that way we can kind of take more time and talk about the background of the houses and how they, you know, originally started at the Century of Progress exposition at the World Exposition in Chicago, the World's Fair, 1933 to 1935. And then we also take that chance to talk about our partnership with the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, the National Park Service, as well as go into detail. This year, we're going to have the lessees of the Florida House, which is the Pink House.
Yes.
It's the most standout house, and they're going to share their story about rehabbing the building from the ground up.
Who are the folks that are living in the house now there in Beverly Shores?
It is the original lessee was Bob Beatty and his wife. So they are residents of the region, and a lot of their expertise is able to help them out in that rehabilitation.
It's such a unique house, and if you get to see the pictures, in fact, it is the information, of course, on the Indiana Landmarks website, but like I said, it's so unusual to see a house like this even around these days. It was quite a project, I understand, to be able to get this Century of Progress home and all the others that are going to be on the tour this year, to get them fixed up and ready to show off here. And especially the House of Tomorrow, which has been recognized, I understand, as the first glass house in the country.
Yes, it has. And it's been, last year we were able to partner with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and they recognize the House of Tomorrow as a national treasure. It is the first glass house glass-walled house in the country, and we certainly hope to elevate its position in the history of architecture through that national treasure designation, and also through its rehabilitation that we're planning here in the coming years.
Now, I know that you're going to work with your former office colleague, Todd Zeiger, because you had a chance before you came over to become the Northwest Indiana Regional Director. You had a chance to work with Todd over in South Bend. Does he look forward to this trek over from South Bend every year to get to do the talk and then turn help with the tour itself?
Certainly, and Todd's very familiar. He's been working very closely with the Park Service for almost 20 years on these homes. So he knows them in and out, and it's certainly a strong passion of his, and really gearing up to really get this last house, the House of Tomorrow, up and running once again.
Now, obviously, since this particular series of the talks and the tours coming up here in later this month is sold out, has Indiana Landmarks considered having an opportunity to come up, if not late in the year, but maybe early in 2019, to be able to extend this for one more opportunity out there, or are we still looking at only once per year?
Well, we are trying to probably keep it to about one time a year, but hopefully maybe extending it, the tour opportunities for that weekend next year. We're going to see how this year goes. Obviously, the demand certainly there, but we also have to take into account the lessees and the occupants of the homes, and also our ability to work with the Park Service, as well as the Dunes National Park Association, two of our partners in the whole program. So we'll have to see next year, but hopefully we can extend it and get more people in and out of those doors.
Now, for those folks who have a chance to be able to get tickets, to be able to be involved in this year's event, it's going to be on Friday, September 28th. The talk is at 7 o'clock in the evening till 9. It's going to be at the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore Visitor Center, which, of course, is on State Road 49 in Porter. And for those folks that are going to have a chance to make the tour, tell us how the setup is for this year, even though it's already sold out.
Yeah. So for those who will be attending and have a ticket, all the tours start at the visitor center. You park your car there, and then we bus you over to the site right on the lakefront. The whole time you'll be guided by a National Park Service ranger or volunteer, and they'll be touring you through each house. You have about 15 or 20 minutes to get through the house. The ranger provides an overview outside, and then you get to go inside, take a look at the interiors, and learn a little bit more from the lessees who did the rehab themselves, and also from other park rangers and volunteers. All said and done, it's about a two and a half hour tour, and it's certainly a once-in-a-lifetime experience, that's for sure.
Now, it's interesting, this particular house, House of Tomorrow, I guess, is the one that I'm sure that brings the most attention. Of course, are the ones that came over from the 1933 visit over in Chicago. And I guess what is always amazing is how they managed to bring the house over after it was shown off over in Chicago. Tell us again how the setup was done here, that I guess the architects and everybody that was involved in the event over in Chicago managed to help bring this to Indiana so it has its permanent place. And, of course, the folks have a chance to live into it now.
Yeah, so it was all part of a real estate scheme, really a development scheme by Robert Bartlett, who was trying to turn Beverly Shores, Indiana, into kind of the next Miami. He had a little bit of a difficulty because of the weather, I'd say. Mm-hmm. But he brought over these Century of Progress homes from Chicago as a way to attract homeowners and visitors. So four of them actually came across the lake on barges. And we have photographs of that. And then the last one, which is the Cypress Log home, actually came over via truck. But the images are quite stunning to see them coming over on barges and then a few of them being lifted up onto the dunes via manpower, animal power, and just good old fastened hand cranks.
So I guess even if nobody can have a chance to actually be involved in the Century Progress talks and tours this year, there's always the display that's always set up on the Indiana Dunes, the Indiana Landmarks website, isn't there?
Yes, there's information on our website. You can certainly always drive through the Century of Progress Historic District. There are interpretive panels along the road there. You can get out and park and walk in front of the houses and read about that. Once in a while, you'll catch a lessee out front. You can always feel free to ask them a question. We always do remind people that these are people's homes and that we should respect their privacy. And then you can always contact Indiana Landmarks, the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, the Dunes National Park Association to learn more about these special homes.
It's always interesting to see these places, and I have not had a chance to actually make the tour itself, but I have had a chance to at least drive by and take a look at the homes. It's certainly a sight that residents here in Indiana as well as Illinois take advantage of when they can. If there's more information that's available out there that's on the website, they can find out more. Brad, how can they find out more?
Certainly, yes. Yeah. So our website is www.indianalandmarks.org. And you can follow our link to the House of Tomorrow specifically. It's one of our special projects, which will tie you into a number of news stories and articles and information about the Century of Progress homes as a whole. And then you can also visit the National Park Service website for the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. I don't have that website off the top of my head, but that's certainly something you can find out at the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore Visitor Center on State Route 49, as you said.
Well, Brad, thanks for talking with us here about the now-sold-out Century of Progress talks that are coming up here on Friday, September 28th. Hopefully the folks will have a chance to get their tickets in time before that half hour that it took to sell out on the Indiana Landmarks website. And let's hope that maybe things will be able to extend in the future. And looking ahead to 2019, I guess maybe an opportunity here maybe to be able to set up a little longer opportunity to not only get the tickets out, but also to be able to extend the talks and the tours themselves next year. Brad, thank you for being with us to talk about this, and good luck, and hope that people that got the tickets will enjoy themselves on the Century Progress talks and tours this year.
Thank you so much for having us, Chris, and we look forward to seeing everyone out there in a couple weeks.
That's Brad Miller. He is the Northwest Indiana Regional Director of Indiana Landmarks. He has his office based in Miller, and he's talking here about the great Century Progress House talks and the tours that are coming up in Beverly Shores. Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses by sponsoring Regionally Speaking. Learn more about all the benefits. Call us at 219-756-5656. There's been a lot of discussion in recent months and even in the last few years about trying to help build a strong and educatable workforce to be able to take on the jobs of the future here in Indiana. Some of the work is being left, of course, to public schools to try to make revisions in the state's graduation requirements. And that is how the Indiana State Board of Education has gotten involved here, to find a way to help come up with employability skills. And in turn, there's been some changes that are being proposed, some recommendations being made on graduation pathways. What the State Board of Education is working on. And we have with us Northwest Indiana's representative on the State Board of Education, Tony Walker. Tony, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good afternoon, Chris.
Thank you, and good afternoon to you. Will you kind of give us a little history lesson here on the concerns that have been voiced over the years, or at least certainly before the State Board of Education, about coming up with a workforce that is able to tackle the jobs and the tasks of the future, and how that kind of relates back to how the high schools in Indiana should be dealing with it?
And this was sort of an interesting history, because typically education policy bubbles up to the state level from the field, from the schools and school districts. But this one, I believe, really came more from industry and came from the employers in the state talking to the elected officials about their troubles filling jobs in the state of Indiana and about the skills of the workforce in Indiana that were showing some concern to a lot of major companies throughout the state that looked to hire workers. And as a result of that, the governor and the State Board of Education and the Indiana General Assembly also came to the conclusion that we needed to change the expectation of high schools in Indiana as to what type of education they're providing kids, and not totally overhaul it and throw out the baby with the bathwater, but right, to make sure that when kids walk across that stage and the diploma is put in their hand, that they can actually do something. Right now, this previously and still right now, the system is sort of slanted toward higher education. But as we know, not all kids are going to go to college, and not all kids are going to even get two-year degrees. So what we as a state board tried to do with graduation pathways is make the high schools responsible for assuring that every student that graduates has some skill set that will allow them to either go on to college or go into the workforce.
When did the State Board of Education get involved in this conversation? Obviously, it's a conversation that started a long time ago in maybe the individual school districts around the state, or in the state employment agencies and the like, that decided this is the people that we have to work with, and these are the jobs that have to be filled, but the education skills are not there as they should be. When was the discussion first brought up, as best as you can tell?
Well, really, you know, education policy is really controlled by the governor of the state. So the conversation's been going on for many, many years under many different governors. But it was Governor Hochul, when he came in, that really said, we're going to address this issue and make it a priority. And within his first year, the state board actually changed the policy and the graduation requirements to put graduation pathways out front.
Tell us how the system is set up right now with recommendations that have been made and ones that have been offered that I guess the State Board of Education will consider in more detail later if need be. How the graduation pathway seems to be shaped up right now?
Well, we've had a tremendous outpouring of support and participation from educators all throughout the state in putting together what we just adopted as a guidance document to school districts to actually implement graduation pathways. I mean, there was a phenomenal number of educators and school districts participating in the development of that doctrine. And where we're at now is trying to encourage school districts to not wait until, you know, for the two-year period or so when it has to be implemented, and try to set systems up now and start forming partnerships with local industry, partnerships with local nonprofits to provide the work-based learning and service-based learning experiences for kids immediately. It's being phased in. So right now, for instance, this graduating class still had to pass our examination in order to get their diploma. Otherwise, they'd have to get a waiver. So we're getting rid of that one-size-fits-all kind of testing out of high school requirement. And so you won't have that test now that you have to pass to graduate, at least the statewide test. And instead, we're looking now for more hardcore evidence that you have developed not only work experience, but service-based experience and project-based learning experiences, which hopefully will help students develop not only hard skill sets, but soft skill sets, that would make them have a smoother transition either into the workforce or into college.
If you will, take us down the options here in a little more detail here. You mentioned starting out about the work-based learning. Tell us more about that and what you're hoping with the employability skills that's put these benchmarks into place, how state school systems as well as the employers can take advantage of that.
And that's going to be part of the challenge of the implementation, particularly in some of our smaller districts in more rural areas. I don't think we'll have as tough a time with implementation here, but sort of what the expectation is that school districts will start forming partnerships with local industry, whether it's U.S. Steel or whatever is in your area, particular area, to develop some opportunities for students to come in and perform internships, for them to get together, say, with United Way, have a partnership with United Way where maybe they go and help do some service projects in their area, where all of that now is credited towards the graduation requirements for public service experiences that the student has, workplace learning experiences that the student has. And then also we're encouraging the school districts within the classroom to move to more of a project-based learning experience and move away from the model slowly but surely of just sitting students in the classroom and talking to them for a 55 minutes or 60 minute period, and then sending them home with homework, and looking to have it to be more of a hands-on, interdisciplinary experience while they're in the classroom, facilitated by the teacher.
Now, I recall when I was in high school, I had opportunities, and some of my fellow students had the opportunities to take advantage of being able to get your classwork done a little early and then take off as long as you were going to a job of some type. Is that something that's being emphasized again to encourage the fact that school districts make room for students to be able to have a job? It might be a benefit to them to what they can learn to be able to find a career in the future?
Yeah, and I think you've just touched upon what's going to be one of the probably biggest challenges in implementing it, is that we're going to have to relook at how schools do their scheduling, whether or not they use block scheduling or whatever kind of scheduling format, to make room for students to be in and out of the building throughout the course of the day. So I think in many ways it's going to go back to what you just explained your experience was, but even probably more of that.
Do you think that even with the changes that are being proposed here to go to opportunities where you've got pathway options like work-based learning, as we've just kind of referred to here, where you have a chance to not only take your classes in school, but also go work in the afternoons, we'll say, at some job, and then service-based learning, as you mentioned, being involved in a civic or a volunteer experiences along with your classroom training, and then of course, the project-based learning, which is what you're hoping to go to, will this change anything dramatically, in your opinion, based on what the current pathway is? That is, that, and we know that it's kind of a veering off a bit, to go into a pathway where a graduate will in turn get his high or her high school diploma or certificate of some kind, and that will kind of aim them perhaps toward higher education, but hopefully first be ready for a job.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a dramatic change because you're going to have more and more students graduating, number one, with college credits, because part of this also is really trying to focus on dual credit programs, which I think are really going to pick up as a result of this as well. So I think you'll have more and more kids, particularly in their junior or senior years, maybe spending part of the day at their high school and then part of the day at Ivy Tech or Indiana University Northwest or Purdue Northwest. So you're going to have a lot more of that going on. But you're also going to have kids that are now not only graduating with a diploma, but are graduating with industry certifications, which will allow them to go and get much more higher paying jobs within the state of Indiana.
And do you think this is also a given opportunity, maybe people hadn't thought of before, to be involved in apprenticeships for some of the trades that still offer apprenticeships?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I'm working on right now with our state board, because currently we don't have a technical education concentrator in plumbing and pipe fitting.
Right.
So I'm trying to establish now in the state of Indiana a pathway for plumbing and pipe fitting, because I have a lot of friends that are plumbers and pipe fitters, and you know what? They're always in demand.
Well, that's what you would think.
The world, apparently.
We're noticing that there's always a demand for plumbers and pipe fitters. There's always a demand for well-experienced carpenters and joiners and some of the other trades, construction trades in particular. We want to see more houses go up, more office buildings go up, and then get them filled, but somebody has to build those.
Absolutely. And that's one of the first meetings I'm looking forward to have is with Northwest Indiana Building Trades Council. As soon as we can get the foundation set and the state approval for having a plumbing and pipe fitting pathway, to see if we can come up with some program that is sort of a precursor to entering into the union trades program up here.
We're talking with Tony Walker, who is Northwest Indiana's representative on the Indiana State Board of Education. The Board of Education is dealing with graduation pathways options that are being made available and being discussed these days. We've talked about the way to help make young people more employable in the workforce as they finish up their high school and maybe some college experience to get a certificate of some type. What kind of changes, if any, are planned in the options for those who are maybe actually going to continue on and head on to college? Any changes in the benchmarks that they're facing, the SATs, the ACTs, the other exams they might have to face?
There are changes that I think are going to really help our graduating college-bound seniors. One, for instance, we're looking at changing our 10th grade standardized test to the actual SAT, and hopefully we'll be able to work it out with the General Assembly for the state to actually cover the cost for students to take that SAT. The other thing, or SAT, ACT, or one of those tests, it hasn't been determined which one yet. But I'm just saying the ones that people know.
I'm sure that there are probably a lot of details that have yet to be worked out, that a lot of this has had some good options that have been offered, but in the discussion, the recommendations that have been made, but you have to come down to actually how to practice this.
Yeah, and the other thing is we're really looking to have strong partnerships with our local state universities. I mean, Ivy Tech has been a great partner, as has Purdue, Northwest, and IUN. So I think there will be more linkages between the local school districts and those universities to assist kids to get more college credits while still in high school. And there's one school, 21st Century Charter School in Gary, that actually pays the fees for their students to take those courses. I don't know how many other school districts actually do that, but that's a possibility. But in every case, those fees are subsidized, and they're cheaper to accrue. It's cheaper to accrue those college credits on a high school dual credit track than it is if you were actually enrolled in the college. So you get the added benefit of, I think you're going to have a lot more high schoolers graduating with a year and maybe some of them even 2 years of college credit under their belt that have been either significantly subsidized or paid for them.
Tony, you're here in Northwest Indiana, so you get to see an area that is still, even though it's reduced in size, still a pretty much industrial area. How do you get to cope and some of these questions that come up and in turn interact, I suppose, with your colleagues on the State Board of Education in some of the other counties elsewhere in Indiana, say in central Indiana, where we find more technology-based jobs and related things, certainly involving higher education. How do you get to be able to see how these pathways are going to be able to, be accomplished in some of these other counties of the state?
Well, one of the things, we have great accountability because we are relying heavily and working on this with Indiana's Department of Workforce Development. That's one of the things I think Governor Holcomb has done that's been unique to his tenure, is pretty much bringing together the workforce development community and the education community totally. We're pretty much working hand in hand in everything. So we have constant access to their data. For instance, you know, they tell us that by 2020, 65% of all the Hoosier jobs are going to require some type of training beyond high school.
That is Tony Walker. He is Northwest Indiana's representative on the Indiana State Board of Education, talking about the work that's underway to adopt the new Indiana graduation pathways before the statewide 2023 deadline. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We hope you'll be with us tomorrow.